has been established that persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder.
Do you believe in ghosts?
First simply disappears, the other two died.
My pretties. It's Ashley Lana, your criminal researcher and non-destructive fear cult leader, welcoming you to another episode where we can examine a true crime case in full detail and reflect on the patterns and consequences. With that being said, welcome to Lullaby. On the previous episode, we discussed the Canadian case of Sandy Charles, the 14-year-old boy who, with the help of a 7-year-old accomplice, murdered a 7-year-old boy with the purpose to collect fat from his body to consume to attain the gift of flight so that he could become a child of Satan. I know, wild. Prior to releasing that episode, I spoke with Eric from the Team TNA podcast, and I had this conversation and it went, Eric, I'm covering this case that involves a teenager getting a 7-year-old to help him murder a virgin child as a sacrifice so he can learn how to fly. And Eric just responded, dude, every word of that sentence gave no hints to the next word. That case, Satan's warlock, Sandy Charles, is bizarre. If you haven't heard it, go back and listen. You can take a lot from that case. All right, in Canada right now, we are going through Fool's Spring, which is where the snow melts, it's beautiful out, it's plus 20, and then the very next day, it's minus 15 and there's a foot of snow. That's where we're at. Canadian environment really likes to give you the razzle-dazzle every now and then. So because it was snowing, I decided I was gonna bunker down in my house and do something that I enjoy doing, which is, surprisingly, deep cleaning the crap out of everything. From vacuuming to sweeping to down on my hands and knees with a toothbrush cleaning my baseboards, because it's absolutely satisfying to have clean baseboards. Am I right? So in that process, I always throw on some movies in the background for some noise. And my topic of choice this week was Y2K horror films. And in that queue was Jeepers Creepers. And I will stop whatever it is I'm doing to watch that opening scene. So I'm watching it, I'm getting goosebumps, and I said, Ashley, you need to cover this case. Yes, Fear Cult, Jeepers Creepers was inspired by a real true crime case. That's why this case is really intriguing. And in the film, you always wonder, why did they go back? Sometimes it's important to go back. My sources for this episode include 1990 news articles, the television programs, Unsolved Mysteries, as well as, wait for it, it's so epic, Man with a Van. Oh man with a van. This show is basically a series where each episode delves into crimes where the criminal utilized his van. Get that? I hope you are ready. So get comfortable, because sweet dreams are made of these. The following case contains mature subject matter involving graphic descriptions of mental illness, suicide, stalking, domestic abuse, and murder. Please take into consideration that not all topics are suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised. Great when all the cows are just lined down the fence so it gives us something to look at.
This drive is always nice during the day. There's something peaceful about driving down a stretch of empty highway.
Not a care in the world.
Exactly. What the heck is this guy doing?
Who?
He's coming in quick. He is going to hit someone.
Look, there he goes. Look at his license plate. It says GZ. Jeez, he must be in a hurry.
Oh, the license plate.
Jeez, he must be in a hurry. Okay, well, I guess I won that round.
It's not like there's many cars on the road.
Well, if it was so easy, why didn't you chime in?
It's fine. I'll get the next one. Hey, look at that creepy-looking schoolhouse.
Oh, that's so creepy. How old do you think that is?
I don't know. No idea.
Hey, look at that. That's the van.
That is the same van.
That's the van that was following us.
What the hell is he doing?
What's he holding? Like, slow down. He's carrying
Where?
Something. Look.
I can't see what he's holding. A sheet?
There's, like, blood on it. What is that? It's, like, red stains.
I think that's blood.
I think it is. He's looking at us.
Oh, God.
He's looking at us. Get me out of here. Get me out of here. Go. Go. Go.
Dennis Henry Depew was born on June 13, 1943, in Sturgis, St. Joseph, Michigan, United States, to Claude and Elma Depew. He completed his education at Burr Oak High School and earned a bachelor's degree in business education from Michigan State University. For over two decades, he worked as a property tax specialist for the state of Michigan in the Department of Treasury. Additionally, he shared his knowledge by teaching business education in Portland, Oregon, and Los Angeles, California. Dennis was an active member of the Burr Oak United Methodist Church and the MSU Alumni Association. Dennis resided in Coldwater, Michigan, where he met his future wife, Marilyn. Marilyn McClenahan was born January 24, 1941, in Detroit, Michigan. She relocated to Coldwater for her career in education. Coldwater, Michigan was a quaint rural town that had a population of around 10,000 in the 1990s. Nestled in a farming community of about 42,000. The town was known for its safety, tranquility, and friendly atmosphere, with minimal crime rates. Marilyn found love in Dennis, and they soon got married, welcoming three lovely children, daughters Jennifer and Julie, and son Scott. The teenage girls attended Coldwater High School, while Marilyn served as the beloved student counselor, earning the admiration of many of her students. The Depew family embraced their religious beliefs, bonding over nightly dinners and worshiping together at church on Sundays. While they appeared content to the community, underlying tensions between Dennis and Marilyn were brewing. According to relatives, Dennis had gradually withdrawn and stopped communicating with his wife after the arrival of their children, isolating himself from his family. At first, their eldest daughter Jennifer disclosed that her parents' disagreements were primarily characterized by a lack of communication and avoidance, rather than heated physical and verbal arguments. Those came later. Dennis's behavior soon progressed into more mentally abusive behavior towards Marilyn. Marilyn began confiding with her coworker, Ann Dunkel, about how her home life was changing dramatically and expressing how unhappy her marriage had become. Dennis expected Marilyn to become a homebound recluse like he was. She explained her frustration with her husband's alarming behavior, revealing that Dennis was imposing controlling restrictions on her. According to Marilyn, Dennis wanted her to conform to his reclusive lifestyle and disapproved of her friendships and community involvement. This pattern of behavior exhibited by Dennis towards Marilyn aligns with the characteristics of emotional and psychological abuse within a domestic relationship. The National Domestic Violence Hotline defines emotional abuse as a form of manipulation and control that can involve isolating the victim from their support systems, monitoring their activities, and undermining their self-worth. Marilyn is fantastic. This woman is an absolute gemstone. She is actively participating in community events. She loves her job as a high school counselor at Coldwater High School. And to make it better, her students adore her. They know they can reach out to her with anything and she'll be motherly and non-judgmental. Her teenage daughters, Jennifer and Julie, love having her around high school. Everyone got excited to see Marilyn. As Dennis grew more miserable and pessimistic, he started resenting his wife Marilyn for being well-liked and laid back. Marilyn was known for her sweet and reserved nature, which only seemed to bother Dennis more. He couldn't stand the fact that she didn't have to be the center of attention to have people drawn to her. In his frustration, Dennis began exhibiting abusive behavior towards Marilyn. Misery loves company. He wanted her to mirror his negative outlook on life, but when she refused to play along, it only got worse. To Dennis, Marilyn's refusal to join him in his misery made her the problem, leading to this cycle of escalating abuse within their relationship. And this is based on statements made by the case investigators and witness testimonies. And I wish I could have found more on Dennis's childhood that would possibly help explain his insecurities as an adult. However, this man had nothing in his history to help understand his current mental state. Regardless, though, many felt that Dennis was insecure and could never accept accountability in his life for his own personal problems when he could not control his wife, leading to verbal abuse. Dennis became hypersensitive, and he reacted with rage when Marilyn would stand up for herself because she wanted her own life. Fuck you, Dennis. If you want to be miserable, you go sit on that couch with a bowl of popcorn. I have plants. I have a community to give back to. No, she wasn't. She didn't come off condescending or anything like that. She was very sweet. But my point is, she stood up for herself. And this caused the children to be more avoidant of Dennis because he reacted negatively to that. And naturally, they leaned more towards Marilyn. Well, Dennis, being the certified fruitcake that he is, starts accusing Marilyn of poisoning his children against him. I hope you can hear those air quotes. And Marilyn is starting to feel scared, but she doesn't want him to see this. She doesn't want her children to see that she's scared of her husband. And she continues to defuse the situation as often as she can. Dennis has not yet progressed to physical abuse yet. According to an article written by Darlene Lancer, featured in Psychology Today, titled "The Truth About Abusers, Abuse, and What to Do," it explains, quote, "You may not realize that abusers feel powerless. In fact, they're often bullies. The one thing they all have in common is that their motive is to have power over their victim. This is because they don't feel that they have personal power, regardless of worldly success. To them, communication is a win-lose game." End quote. About to drop some facts on you, Fear Cult. The National Voice of Victims and Home for Advocates, National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, states that on average, 20 people per minute are physically abused by an intimate partner in the United States alone. 1 in 9 men and 1 in 4 women experience severe intimate partner physical violence, including stalking with impacts and traumatic stress disorder. And the presence of a gun in a domestic violence situation increases the risk of homicide by 500%. 72% of all murder suicides involve an intimate partner, and 94% of the victims of these murder suicides are female. As well as 1 in 15 children are exposed to intimate partner violence each year, and 90% of these children are eyewitnesses to this violence. Now, you can visit ncadv.org for more information. On a typical day, there are more than 20,000 phone calls placed to domestic violence hotlines nationwide. Now, Fear Cult, for anonymous confidential help 24/7, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233. I pray that no one here needs to call that number. No one should have to experience domestic abuse. It's disgusting. Now, I'm going to quote this because it's important for people to know this. The domestic violence hotline states, quote, "If you are being abused by your partner, know there is nothing you have done or are doing to cause the abuse. It is solely the choice of the abuser to abuse," end quote. After 18 years of marriage, Marilyn has had enough of this abuse. Finito. I'm over it, papi. She no longer knows the man she had once fallen in love with, and she is sick of having to fight for her independence. Go, girl. And she protects her 3 children by filing for divorce in April 1989. Dennis was shocked when Marilyn expressed her need for a divorce. He refused to accept it and insisted that she stay with him, claiming that nobody could love her the way he did and that their marriage problems were her doing, not his. As the situation spiraled out of control, Dennis's behavior became more erratic and volatile. The news of the divorce sent Dennis into a rage, leading him to throwing fits and verbally attacking Marilyn. Fearing for her safety, Marilyn had to kick Dennis out of the house and prevent him from seeing the children for their safety. She was worried that he might try to force his way back in. Former prosecutor John Livesay confirmed that the family lived in fear of Dennis, concerned that he might pose a threat. Despite Dennis's protests, the divorce was finalized in December 1989. Marilyn's lawyer, Richard Kohlbach, explained that Marilyn wanted to break free from Dennis's control and shield the children from his accusations. During the divorce proceedings, Dennis reluctantly agreed to grant Marilyn custody and permitted her to keep most of the property she requested. Through everything, Dennis was granted access to the guest house, which he used as an office. Marilyn had to change all the locks in the main house. And unfortunately, Dennis continued to dismiss the boundaries, and Marilyn found herself coming home to find Dennis sitting on her couch waiting for her. He would plead for her to take him back, and when she refused, he only got more angry. After he would leave, he would complain to his co-workers, specifically Jay Markowski. Markowski revealed that Dennis had mentioned thoughts of suicide and even contemplating first-degree murder. On April 15, 1990, Dennis arrived at Maryland's to pick up his kids, Jennifer and Scott, for his scheduled court-ordered visitation. His youngest daughter, Julie, had already refused to go over that day. Scott was very reluctant to spend time with his father during his visitation periods and started telling his father that he didn't want to go with him, that it wasn't fair that Julie didn't have to go. Dennis tried to grab Scott when Marilyn stepped in and defended her son's decisions, saying that he was old enough to make his own. Dennis punched Marilyn in the face while screaming that she was poisoning their children's minds. Dennis erupted, throwing her against the wall before forcefully pushing her down into the basement. She rolled down the stairs as the children cried out in fear as their father followed behind and continued his brutal attack on their mother, who was bleeding at the bottom of the steps. Jennifer, the eldest, raced to the neighbor's house to call the police. As Dennis callously lifted up Marilyn's limp body, he forced her dazed form up the stairs past her crying children. Her daughter Julie cried out asking if she was all right, but her mother's eyes were glazed over and weak. Dennis placed Marilyn into the passenger seat of his 1984 brown and cream-colored Chevrolet van. He assured his terrified children that their mother was going to be okay and he was only taking her to the hospital. But later, when an officer arrived at the hospital, it became chillingly clear that neither Dennis nor Marilyn had arrived as promised. Later that same day, Ray and Marie Thornton were enjoying a leisurely country drive through the remote backroads of southern Michigan and northern Indiana. Ray was a worker at a machine shop in Elkhart, Indiana, and Marie, a dedicated nurse aide. Together, they cherished their moments away from their bustling lives to reconnect and unwind without the presence of their children. As they cruised along Snow Prairie Road, 12 miles outside of Coldwater, Michigan, the couple reveled in their tranquil surroundings. Together, they liked to play the license plate game, when and if they ever saw another vehicle. The first to make words from the license plate won a point. It was these small little trips that brought the couple together. However, their peaceful drive took a sinister turn when Ray noticed a 1984 brown and cream Chevrolet van with maroon panels tailing them in the rearview mirror. The van was coming up fast. Feeling uneasy, Ray picked up speed, but the van aggressively overtook them as they ascended a hill, leaving Ray and Marie unsettled by its reckless behavior. Marie, being always observant, pointed out that the van's license plate began with the letters GZ, prompting her to joke, "Geez, he must be in a hurry." They then watched the van disappear ahead down the road. Several miles later, their eyes widened in horror as they approached a secluded old schoolhouse and spotted a man carrying what looked like a blood-soaked sheet. Marie, with her medical training, immediately recognized the sight. She urgently drew Ray's attention to the man as they drove past, only to realize that the same brown and cream-colored Chevrolet van was parked nearby, nestled between the school and a looming tank. At first, Ray initially dismissed the blood as paint. He assumed that the man must be foolish not to realize that someone would drive by and see him. He reasoned that any criminal would have had a sense to hide evidence before being discovered. Feeling frightened, Ray and Marie sped off down the highway, back towards Indiana. But it didn't take long for the van to catch up and began tailgating them even closer. Dennis Depew's menacing presence made Ray and Marie nervous, evident from their frantic glances behind them. Marie quickly grabbed a pen and paper from the glove compartment and began jotting down details of the van, hoping to catch the license plate again. She already remembered the first two digits, GZ, because of the joke she made earlier. As the van continued to trail close behind them, Ray made the quick decision to veer down a different road, hoping to evade their pursuer. The van continued ahead a few yards before pulling off to the side of the road. Ray's internal doubts about the bloodied sheet lingered in his head, speculating that it could be red paint from a painter working at the school. At least that's what he hoped. They turned back onto the road and began driving again. Ray and Marie spotted the man changing the license plate on the van, with the inside passenger door drenched in blood hanging open. Ray's instincts kicked in. He was certain the man was concealing something criminal, and he made the decision to turn around and go back to the abandoned school. Ray and Marie wasted no time heading back to the old schoolhouse, parking their car at the entrance before searching the eerie property. It wasn't long before they stumbled upon a small brush ditch where the man had disposed of the blood-soaked sheet. With trembling hands, Ray carefully lifted the stained material, only to make a horrifying discovery. It was not just blood, but also fragments of bone and human skin clinging to the fabric, as identified by his wife Marie, who was a nurse. Horrified, they hurried back to their car and raced to find the nearest phone to alert the authorities. They eventually arrived at a secluded farm and urgently knocked on the door, desperate for help. The farm's occupants were initially taken back by the frantic couple's claims of murder. Luckily, they agreed to call the police, but insisted that Ray and Marie had to wait outside. As the couple waited by their car, a sense of dread crept over them, realizing that they could be in imminent danger if the killer returned. They leaned up against their car as the sun began to set, staring down the open road, waiting for the police. The state officer finally arrived, and he decided to accompany the couple back to the old schoolhouse, where they provided their account of the events. The officer assured the couple that if they needed any further information, they would be contacted. Ray and Marie were free to go home. The morning after the events of April 15, 1990, a road commission worker in Branch County made a horrifying discovery. The mutilated body of 49-year-old Marilyn Depew. It was found near a tree by the roadside. She had been tragically shot point-blank range in the back of her head. Police quickly turned their attention to 47-year-old Dennis Depew as the prime suspect, who was now on the run. It was suspected that Dennis had committed the act following his divorce from Marilyn, driven by a need to assert control over their lives. He withdrew thousands of dollars from his bank and warned his workplace that he was going to be gone for a while. Dennis vanished, leaving an incriminating trail of evidence behind him. Police quickly took action to secure the safety of the Depew children, placing them in protective custody. As investigators delved deeper, fresh evidence emerged at the schoolhouse, including fresh tire tracks that matched Dennis's van and a pool of blood matching Marilyn's. The Branch County Sheriff's Department escalated the search, seeking assistance from the federal authorities. Dennis, considered armed and dangerous, had changed his license plates, evading capture despite being easy to recognize at 6 feet tall, weighing 200 pounds, with distinctive dark brown hair and deep-set brown eyes. Driving a 1984 brown and cream-colored Chevrolet van with Illinois license plates, Dennis Depew remained at large, a menacing figure on the run. Dennis is gone, nowhere to be found. And when I say this man has a very distinct face, I mean that. He looks very... Do you remember the sugar water guy from Men in Black? Oh, man, I hope I'm not the only one that laughed. Be serious, Ashley. No, but that's what Dennis looked like. As if he were an alien cockroach wearing a human skin suit. He's a killer, I can say this. Now, that was me justifying my actions. This guy has mentally and physically assaulted his wife in front of his teenage kids, and now he has murdered her in cold blood in the passenger seat of his van, and he dumps her body on the side of the road. This is a woman he was married to for 18 years. 2 weeks after the murder of Marilyn, two of her co-workers at Coldwater High School, Principal Stan Bushouse and Ann Dunkel, received two large, no-named envelopes in the mail, postmarked in Arlington, Virginia. Inside were pages of handwritten letters explaining why they were the direct cause of Marilyn's impending death. Now, Marilyn had already been murdered by Dennis at this point, but Dennis never stated she was already dead. And Dennis accused Marilyn's co-workers of convincing her to leave him and writing, quote, "An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a lie for a lie, a life for a life." Fear called. Fear called. This man is quoting a Babylonian proverb that was later used in the Bible to justify he murdered his wife. Matthew 5:38. No, I didn't just guess that. I Googled it. I didn't know. So Dennis sent a total of 17 13-page letters, all postmarked from different Virginia states across America, including Oklahoma, Virginia, and Iowa. Now, throughout these pages, he takes biblical references to rationalize his actions, such as, quote, "I realize that vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, but sometimes the Lord is too busy doing other things," end quote. Marilyn's co-worker Ann Dunkel stated, quote, "It seems as if Dennis was trying to say that those of us who were friends with Marilyn were the ones who caused her death, when in effect it was Dennis who pulled the trigger. None of the rest of us did that," end quote. Principal Stan Bushouse, he immediately contacted the Sheriff's Department, Stan was truly concerned over the safety of his own family, and the officers warned him to be cautious because Dennis Depew was still on the loose, and no one knew what he was capable of. Dennis also sent his co-worker, Jay Markowski, a rambling letter that stated, quote, "Marilyn had many, many opportunities to treat me fairly during this divorce, but she chose to string it out, trick me, lie to me. And when you lose your wife, children, and home, there's not much left," end quote. In that letter, Dennis requested Markowski not show anyone except for six other people, one of those being his own wife. The letter is in chicken scratch and it's a little tricky to read. However, it's pages and pages of Dennis justifying his actions and blaming everyone but himself for his decisions, and that they should have seen it coming. Misery loves company, and Dennis wanted to play the victim in his wife's murder case so bad. He believed that after his divorce, he was too old to start a new life. Spare me, Dennis. Grow up. He was 47 years old. Now, from what I see, is a person with 47 years of life experience. You're not starting over. You're merely flipping the page and starting a new chapter. That's just my two cents. I'm a realist and I'm optimistic. So Dennis decided to kill his wife, and that's where he's going to get a little bit roasted by yours truly. Grow up, Dennis. So these whiny letters were sent to Dennis and Marilyn's friends and coworkers. He also sent it to the newspaper and the judge who handled their divorce. Now, as quickly as the investigators looked for leads on Dennis, the letters began to stop. And this caused the investigation to become cold. The investigators contacted the national television show Unsolved Mysteries. They wanted them to cover the case of Dennis Depew to raise awareness in the search and have the country keep an eye out for him. And it gets juicy. Let's continue. On March 21st, 1991, 9 months after the death of Marilyn Depew, an episode of Unsolved Mysteries aired across the nation, hoping one of the viewers would recognize the face of Dennis Depew. Luckily, a man just outside of Dallas, Texas, had been watching that night. It was roughly 8:30 p.m. when Hank Queen had been staring at the television in awe of the gruesome murder of Marilyn Depew being depicted on the television. While he watched, he was waiting for his girlfriend to come home. He intently watched the interviews of former friends and relatives of the victims that were conducted and shown. Hank took note of the gruesome details, including the suspect's van. Soon after, Hank's girlfriend Linda came home and began settling her things in the kitchen. Hank explained that his mother had suffered a stroke and he waited until she got home to leave, as he was unable to reach her all day. Linda started preparing sandwiches for his long drive as Hank detailed his mother's illness. Hank and Linda went outside to his vehicle and they kissed each other goodbye, and Hank left the television on. Afterwards, Linda never went back into the living room, but she was startled when her friend arrived in a panic, warning her that Hank had been living under a false identity to conceal his true identity as Dennis Depew, the man featured on Unsolved Mysteries. Realizing the potential danger she was in, Linda immediately contacted the show, providing them with information about Hank's identity and the sudden departure in his van. Suspicion heightened when Linda recalled arriving home that night. Hank's 1984 Chevrolet van was parked in the driveway, contrary to its usual practice of keeping it in the garage. She had already previously noted the license plate number, which she promptly shared with the authorities. A six-state alert was issued in the search for Dennis Depew. 4 hours later, Dennis had managed to speed from Texas to Louisiana, where he was caught speeding by a state trooper. As the trooper followed behind, he called in the plate number and learned that Dennis was wanted for murder. Dennis knew that he was caught and decided to make a break for it. What followed was a dramatic high-speed chase that spanned across the state lines, with Dennis evading law enforcement from both Texas and Louisiana. As the pursuit intensified, Dennis ran through two separate police roadblocks with officers from both states hot on his trail. In the dark of night, police resorted to shooting out the rear tires of Dennis's van, creating a spectacle of sparks as he continued to drive until the van eventually came to a halt. In a desperate final act, Dennis fired a .357 caliber Magnum out his driver's window at the Warren County deputies and Vicksburg police before turning the gun on himself. His lifeless body was discovered slumped behind the wheel of the van at around 4 a.m. 47-year-old Dennis Depew had made a choice between facing the consequences of his actions in court or ending his own life to avoid trial. He chose death. Louisiana Sheriff Paul Barrett said, quote, "My wife and I had watched the TV program about him, and the next morning, I'm with the officers firing into his van." As the days passed, the grandparents of the Depew children, with the assistance of Principal Stan Bushouse, ensured the safety and well-being of Jennifer, Julie, and Scott, relocating them to start fresh lives away from Coldwater and the traumatic experiences associated with the memories of their father. Investigators strongly believed that if it were not for the intervention of Ray and Marie Thornton, who inadvertently caused Dennis to flee out of state by discovering him with the incriminating blood-soaked sheet and returning to the schoolhouse, Dennis may have returned to murder his own children. Marilyn's mother, Betty, left with these words. "We had a feeling that he had done something terrible. It was so brutal and premeditated that it makes you so angry. If she'd been killed in an automobile accident, you could get over that. But not this. The only closure that we could get out of it would be to have Dennis caught. That's the only thing. I can't think of anything else that would help me. I think of it day and night, and I will for the rest of my life. And nothing, even Dennis being caught, will not take this terrible feeling away." That is the true case of Dennis Depew and the inspiration for the horror film Jeepers Creepers. I want to say thank you for Fear Cult member Mitchell for providing his voice for the dramatization this week. The Fear Cult thanks you, and thanks you for being a part of this journey.
There'll be more, many more. They're coming for me now. And then they'll come for you.
Back on our never-ending quest to find a truly scary movie, I am recommending the 2001 thriller Joyride, starring Steve Zahn and the late, great Paul Walker. Plot follows three young people on a road trip from Colorado to New Jersey who start talking to a trucker on their CB radio as a prank. Then they must escape when it turns out the man is a psychopath. You can watch the trailer at lullabythefearpodcast.com/neverendingquest, as well as see the list of previous recommendations. Now I tried to scare you, now you try to scare me. Follow Lullaby on Instagram at lullabythefearpodcast for more updates, and send me your horror movie recommendations. Thank you for listening to this week's Lullaby. Sweet dreams. Lights out.